Welcome to the holiday break episode of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. I'm Lisa Schmeiser, and I have no idea what day it is.
Thank you, Lisa Schmeiser, for welcoming me here. This is a wonderful holiday break podcast.
Who are you?
I'm Philip Michaels, your co-host.
Do you know what day it is?
It's Tuesday.
Point taken. We're here because we've just sacrificed our sanity for the greater good for our audience.
Yes.
And we've seen Cats. Mm. So today we'll be talking about Cats. We will also be discussing three trailers we've seen lately: Dr. Dolittle, Birds of Prey, and Wonder Woman 84.
Yes. Right. That is all correct.
Would you like to commence discussing the trailers?
Yes, let's start with the trailers. Since we have discussed Cats on a previous episode, back when it was a trailer, and of course the purpose of this podcast is we don't go see movies, and boy, Cats really affirms that as the right decision. But let's talk about Dolittle first, which is its official title.
Mm-hmm.
This was a trailer we actually saw when we went to go see Cats.
It's thematic.
You were off buying popcorn at the time, so you did not actually see it. And when the slow jam version of What a Wonderful World kicks in, I knew, oh man, we are in for a treat with Robert Downey Jr. as the eponymous Dolittle.
I think, Philip, one of our resolutions for 2020 is to make a list of songs that are never allowed to be used in movie trailers again.
Mm-hmm.
Or movies.
Yes.
Let's ban these things for movies. And here we go. Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll.
Yep. Retired.
All right. That's retired. George Thorogood's
Born to Be Bad or
Bad to the Bone.
Bad to the Bone.
No. Yes. That one.
However, you can use one scotch, one whiskey, one beer in your next trailer. keep using that George Thorogood and Double D song.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to also propose any version of It's a Wonderful World.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yes. Especially this one.
Yes. Especially when, and we talked about this before on the podcast, but really, if you're putting together a trailer and you're all, let's do that song, but let's make it sad or have a choir of children sing it.
Mm-hmm.
No, because it's cliched. It's the in a world of the 2000s.
Yes.
In a world where children sing pop songs, but slowly and sadly. This movie is something you'll enjoy.
So even if we strip out the musical choice for the trailer, which is frankly, I feel like the musical choice was there to make us read something into the trailer that may not necessarily be there. The bare bones of the trailer seem to suggest that Dr. Dolittle has been living in enjoyable seclusion with many animal pals until some winsome child compels him to leave his house. They go on an adventure.
There's a quest.
And there's lots and lots of colonialist tropes along the way.
I will bet.
Mm-hmm.
I will bet $5 cash American money.
Ooh.
That there is some sort of prophecy.
I want to.
A prophecy says that man who speaks to animals.
I will take that bet against you, and okay. I want my pay off in Sacagawea dollars.
Okay. All very right. Well.
There you go.
The moment that you actually released an audible sigh.
Uh huh.
Was not when the children start or the slow hipster doofus started singing.
What a wonderful world.
It was when the words from the producer of Alice in Wonderland appeared on the screen. That was when you just went, ugh. And we should mention, this is not the delightful Disney animated Alice in Wonderland. This was the nightmarish Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland. Again, a movie where there was a prophecy that a girl would come and go to a mad tea party and rid the land of the Queen of Hearts or something.
So I have a really conflicted relationship with any sort of narrative where a prophecy drives it, because what it suggests is that futures are predetermined and we are slaves to a destiny that we really can't shape. And the real prize is the friends we made along the way.
Yes.
I don't like the prophecy as a trope. No. I don't. And what I'd like to see, if anyone ever invokes a prophecy again, is the person shrugging going, "Nah."
It's a 30-minute movie. The prophecy says that you're the one to deliver us, Dr. Dolittle. No, I like it here.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Exactly.
Oh. End of movie. Roll credits. What a wonderful world.
I think the reason I sighed is one of my complaints about the Alice in Wonderland movies is they've...
CGI'd it to a fairly well.
So what I'm struggling to say is they create this really rich visual vocabulary, and I think that's an important part of filmmaking because it helps create the consensual reality that the moviegoer enters into. But that can't substitute for a plot with any internal coherence whatsoever. There's a famous series. There's a famous Vogue editorial where a model plays Alice in Wonderland, and all these different designers play like the Caterpillar and the Mad Hatter and this and that. And the reason it works is because it's a series of lush still shots and it's a dreamscape. And as an editorial viewer, you have the ability to kind of like read in the subtext and, oh, it's great that John Galliano happens to be the Caterpillar. No, it was Marc Jacobs. Anyway, the point is,
shame on you.
The point is that works when the medium is print. It's harder to do when the medium is film because film has to have some sort of narrative logic to move it along, or it has to have some sort of emotional logic. And in the Alice in Wonderland movies that Tim Burton has done, he's so good at creating a visual universe, but it's like a candy shell with a big ball of air inside.
I just remember going to see that Alice in Wonderland movie, and there's the scene at the end where
Johnny Depp breakdances.
Johnny Depp does a breakdance, and that was so clearly it's the Poochie effect on The Simpsons, where someone says, he's got to be an in-your-face Mad Hatter. He's a Mad Hatter that the kids today can deal with.
The other reason I saw it, because they're like, oh, it's from the producer of Alice in Wonderland and Maleficent, is these guys think that just reworking the material is subversive.
Right.
But they don't ever scratch below the surface to the elements that make these stories compelling in the first place. And the thing I've always found really interesting about Dr. Doolittle, the thing I found fascinating when I was a kid, was imagine being able to talk to animals. But like, imagine if the animals didn't, like, the animals had animal agendas and they really don't care to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Or their priorities are just so different, where if you're Dr. Doolittle, you're like, never, ever, ever go on a picnic, answer insufferable. They're all like talking about side hustles constantly. They are just terrible personal productivity experts. That's the kind of world I want to see, where like you can talk to the animals, but you and the animals really have nothing to say to each other.
Right. And did you ever see the Rex Harrison version?
No, I did not.
It's a bit of a drag. Yeah. It is about 1,000 hours long. Yeah. And I wouldn't recommend it. I don't know why people keep going back to the well on this one.
Because the idea of being able to communicate across species is compelling. Mm. I just want a story where people communicate across species and discover that other species think we're jerks.
Because it seems like it seems like this one is going the Eddie Murphy Doolittle route, where there are 1,000 celebrity voices.
Yeah.
Where you're supposed to, yeah, it's Michael Sheen is the lemur.
I don't begrudge the actors from doing voice work. It sounds like a great gig.
No, that is such a great gig.
Like, you drive there in your sweats and you say your lines.
If there are any voice work casting directors listening to this podcast, I can I can literally do 4 voices. So,
and he will do them all for you.
And I will do them all. And yes, but no, you're right. You show up and you do your 2 days of work alone in the studio. You take your check and then you show up at the premiere and you go, I did lend my voice to that. Holy God.
I had to become the lemur. So it's going to be beautiful. I mean, the trailer, all of these images reminded me a whole lot of that Vogue spread that Grace Coddington art directed. Mm-hmm. And you know, Robert Downey,
who was Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Oh my gosh, I can't remember.
If you have any memories of this Vogue spread that Lisa has mentioned, write in with who was in it. And
or, you know, we can always tweet it out. It can look up later.
Yeah.
I keep thinking that maybe what I should do with So What Who Cares is include show notes for this podcast in it.
You probably should.
So this way.
Lisa, for those people who just heard that string of words and don't know what you're talking about, what is So What Who Cares?
If you go to tinyletter.com/LSCHMEISER, it's my newsletter, published on a violently irregular schedule. Where
really? people who like the TikTok nature of this podcast must be shocked that things come out irregularly. It's so unlike you and me.
I'll have you know, I put an Outlook note on our calendars, so we're committing to a more regular schedule.
Okay.
But anyway, tinyletter.com/LSCHMEISER is my is my delightful spontaneous newsletter where I make reading recommendations, chew on news, and do a lot of, I'd say, explanatory reporting. Mm-hmm. My interest in news tends to be over stories that take a couple years to develop. And then I skip through the dots and explain what it means and where it's all going. And it's also Futurama GIFs.
Okay.
I do that too. So anyway, show notes and so what, who cares? I think it's an idea. I'm confident that Robert Downey Jr. will do Robert Downey Jr. level work, which is consistently good. It's always a pleasure to watch him. It is.
I'm making a face, which is why Lisa suddenly became defensive there.
Are you remembering Sherlock?
I'm remembering Sherlock Holmes, and apparently I'm one of the we're like the very few people who hate that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, this is true.
Some people really, really like that movie.
I think what I respect about Robert Downey Jr. as an actor is he really does... Look, there's a couple core notes he plays in all of his characters, but to his credit, he really tries to differentiate between them. Your Sherlock is nowhere near Tony Stark, who is nowhere near the character he played in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and I'm confident he'll find some way to interpret...
Bring something new to the table with Dr. Doolittle.
And now that's more time than I've ever wanted to spend talking about Dr. Doolittle.
Okay, so let's talk about something else you clearly really enjoyed when we watched the trailer together. Birds of Prey, or The Emancipation of Harley Quinn, I believe is the full title.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
That's an excellent title
for what looks to be just a tedious time at the movies.
So actually, I want to discuss...
One of my least favorite comic book characters in recorded history.
Yeah, the thing is she started off as a TV character and then they spun her back.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this actually in conjunction with the third trailer, Wonder Woman. Because when I looked at both of these trailers, the first thing I thought to myself is, how is DC going to make these work in a post-Captain Marvel world?
Mm-hmm. This is Wonder Woman 1984, we should say. We are not watching really old trailers.
No. Because one of the things that I really liked about Captain Marvel, well, there are several things I really, really liked about Captain Marvel, but one of the things is it's got like no male gaze whatsoever.
I mean,
she is dressed for battle. She's a pilot. She's confident. She's got friendships that are not based on bonding over how terrible men are, but rather over mutual interests that, you know, feed them as people. And, you know, watching that movie is exciting, but it's also, again, as a lady person, relaxing, because there was never that moment where you get the gratuitous butt in the uniform shot.
Right. And there was, and the one time there's a guy going, "You need me, Captain Marvel," he gets blowed up real good.
Oh yeah, it's so great.
Yeah.
So the challenge that DC already had with Harley Quinn is she was explicitly created as an accessory or foil to the Joker. And the idea was, isn't it funny that she loves him and she exasperates him? And oh, what a problem.
And in the cartoon, the Batman cartoons of the 1990s, it's actually a funny character because it's very much a comedic. It's
like if George Burns and Gracie Allen.
I was about to say, it's Gracie Allen going, "Oh, George, you're a super criminal. Gracie, I'm going to murder you when the camera's off."
Look, it's two of Phil's four voices.
I've got a audition reel, and you can cheerfully supplied. Anyhow, yeah. But as it became a comic book character, and especially in the... That god-awful Suicide Squad movie.
Yeah.
It's Harley Quinn's sex kitten. It's Harley Quinn.
It's Harley Quinn blow-up doll.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be fair, in the comics universe, there has been a huge effort to rehab her image. There's been an entire book centered around her breakup and her realizing it was a terrible relationship and the narrative thread of... How do abuse victims rebuild their sense of self after this huge defining event is done but never really done? So, you know, kudos to the editor who like went along with that idea instead of like, no, we think it's exciting when she is persistently an abuse victim. Also, the cynic in me thinks that one of the reasons they rehabbed Harley Quinn is because they also did her in a kid's comic. And it's really hard to explain to little girls like what Harley Quinn used to be like. There's been some attempt at rehab. One gets the feeling that this movie was greenlit because Margot Robbie is a lot of fun to watch on screen, and she's tremendously talented and she's beautiful. And if she's a draw and she at the box office, you would be dumb not to give her a movie.
People say that, and yet having not seen I, Tonya, or some of the other stuff that she's done, the stuff that I have seen her in, which has been like Suicide Squad and The Big Short, and where she's only in for a cup of coffee, to be fair. I don't see the appeal.
So
I don't get it.
So I think like a decade ago, there was a show on TV called Pan Am, which is about the high flying.
Yeah, it was on NBC, again, literally for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it was like a season. High flying stewardesses of the 1960s. It was meant as a vehicle for Christina Ricci. Except here's the thing, is they cast Margot Robbie as a stewardess who like runs away from fiancé on a wedding day and, you know, flies. And she's like a metaphor for liberation, blah, blah, blah. And I remember when that show came on and it premiered, I was like astonished because she pops off the screen. It's the same way when you watch a movie sometimes. For example, the first time you watch Mystic Pizza, you watch Julia Roberts pop off the screen and you're like, oh, this woman is going places. Or when you and I watched Wet Hot American Summer and we love the state and we love their work. But you look at Elizabeth Banks pop off the screen or Paul Rudd pop off the screen in all the scenes and you're like, oh, there's something. And that was the Margot Robbie experience.
Okay.
So that's what you get is you've got somebody who has tremendous presence. And like I said, she's fun to watch. I didn't like Suicide Squad. I admire her work ethic for committing to a garbage fire of a role. That said, I keep coming back to the question, how does DC make two titles centered around women in the post Captain Marvel age? Because what both of these trailers suggest to me is they still don't understand why and how superhero movies land. Like, you know, you and I watched the Wonder Woman trailer with the how does it feel, the New Order and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's New Order. And you were like, oh, somebody watched Thor Ragnarok and got an idea. And the thing that made Thor Ragnarok work is it's evident what the influences were, but it's very of the moment. You don't have to go back and mine that Stranger Things-induced nostalgia to get goodwill.
No.
And the other thing that also got me about the sequel to Wonder Woman is, oh, they bring back the Amazons because everyone loved the Amazons the first time around. So, of course, they have flashbacks to more Amazons. And really? No. Keep it moving forward. And that was actually the thing that Thor Ragnarok does, is it moves everything forward. The influences are there, but they're not overt. They don't rely on nostalgia. And it moves the story forward. And I keep asking myself, how is this movie going to fit into like their DC shared movies universe where by the end of it, Diana is clearly open to making eyes at Bruce. So we know something's going to happen to Steve again.
Yes.
She's still running around those darn heels and a mini skirt, which again, post Captain Marvel universe and Birds of Prey, I can see where they're trying to do something a little bit different, but
yeah, as you said earlier, there's no butt shot in Captain Marvel. I get the feeling Wonder Woman is going to have butt shots of, like on the 15s.
Yeah.
Like, we are 30 minutes into this movie, butt shot.
We're not paying for Gal Gadot's accent. We're paying for how she looks in the swimsuit.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the Birds of Prey comics.
Yes, I know that.
And one of the reasons
did you kind of have a soft spot for the TV series, or did you think they got it horribly wrong?
I've never seen the TV series.
Oh, that's right.
To be honest,
yeah.
I do, however, watch the Arrowverse, and one of the strengths of the Berlantiverse is that there's always really strong relationships between the women, where they're friends and they're fighters together and they're collaborators and they respect each other. This looks like origin movie part two, where Suicide Squad was, oh, let's get a gang of violent thugs together, and now it's let's get a gang of pissed off women together, and I'm tired of origin stories, man.
Yeah.
Like, just what you could do if you were going to make this story right is you basically drop us into where Harley's already got a bunch of gal pals and there are a few lines dropped here and there about how they all got together. But we see them have the pleasure of working together as a team and tackling evil Ewan McGregor, as opposed to, oh, well, now they have a common threat, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm not interested in that anymore.
Mm.
It's boring. It's done.
Yes.
So,
well, that, yeah, if I never see another origin story in my life, I'll be a thrilled, happy boy.
And I also feel like sequel directors, people, yes. Lots of shiny sequins.
Oscar De La Renta, you're on notice.
I feel like sequel directors do have a hard job to do because their job is to effectively keep the money coming in.
Yes.
Advance the intellectual property, keep the little kids buying the toys. So there's a lot on the line and you may not have the same latitude, but it baffles me that we are more than a decade into watching the MCU set up what is effectively a content machine that manages to print money and still allow for several different types of movies and top level casts and decent storytelling that advance an understanding of a shared universe. And DC has not figured out how to do that. Like, why not?
Well, they handed the main property over to the wrong guy.
Yeah.
Is the big problem when you hand something over to Zack Snyder, you are not really sowing the seeds for a wonderful narrative.
Yeah.
Years from now.
Yeah, and the counterpoint is when Marvel started making movies, everyone's like, oh, it's not going to work because, you know, the X-Men are tied up elsewhere and they're the real property and, you know, the Avengers. Huh? Like, Patton Oswalt actually has a bit from, I want to say, about 15 years ago joking about, oh, the Avengers, they'll take anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're DC and you realize that Zack Snyder has faffed up your marquee team, there are so many other teams you could have done. There are so many different ways you could have gone. You could have even actually found a way to expand the Berlantiverse sensibility into cinema. And they, again, chose not to do that. So.
Not only did they choose not to do it, they like deliberately...
were like, no,
people enjoy those shows. we want people to sit in our movies and feel uncomfortable and sad. Like they've wasted 2 hours of their life.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I feel like you should just kind of go back to the drawing board, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe actually read some DC comics and see what works. I don't know. Crazy idea.
Yeah, that's the other the other thing about comic book movies that I love besides origin stories is hitting that reboot button.
Well, why not?
Those are the two best things about comic book movies. Third is blowing up cities because we don't get to see that enough in the real world.
Oh my goodness.
And that is Phil's complaint
about comic book movies. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I said, it's hard for me to get excited about either Wonder Woman or Birds of Prey because I don't trust the people in charge of the films at DC to make films aimed at anything other than who they think their audience is.
They brought back the original director of Wonder Woman, correct?
They brought back Patty Jenkins. Good.
I think. If they did, then that's a good sign. Because she, apart from the last 20 minutes of the original,
which you hate,
which I did not care for, mm-hmm. She did a good job with the first one.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Mm. I'm not feeling optimistic about it because the trailer does not make me excited for how she's treated. And like I said, both of these movies now take place in a post Captain Marvel world. And for all that Captain Marvel doesn't enjoy the same buzz as, say, Black Panther or Thor or an Avengers movie, the truth is it did actually change the visual vocabulary of how you shoot women in film. And it did actually prove that you could make a movie where the woman is not contractually obligated to run around in high heels and makeup. And my real superpower is being appealing. So
it is almost like the DC people are a race of aliens that have observed from afar. You humans seem to like superhero movies that do this.
Yeah,
and it's like they copying the notes of what they think.
What they've done is they've looked at like Google search results and concluded that's actually what people want.
Yeah.
And if anything, I'd argue that's a lagging indicator.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe the reason you're so disappointed in those trailers is because you've just had a disappointing experience at the theater itself.
Oh,
having gone to see Cats.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I will accept that explanation. We did see Cats. I'm sure there are lots of places where you can find out what's wrong with it. We're going to add to that. Here be spoilers.
Yes.
In case.
Oh man, the people. Yeah. Don't listen to this if you're holding out. If you haven't seen Cats yet.
Yeah.
If the lines have been too long at your local cinema.
If you're like, no, wait, I want to go into the surprise.
Yes. I can't believe Old Deuteronomy is Rum-Tum Tugger's father.
Yeah. I know, especially since Old Deuteronomy is played by Judi Dench. Yeah. There's a lot of biological how-tos going on there. So I have not yet ranked the things that stick out as an, oh God, why?
Well,
but they're there.
I'm not the first person to make this observation, but the problem with cats... Mm-hmm. It's a difficult matter. No, the problem with cats is that when they decided to do this movie, originally they were going to make it animated, which would have been all right.
Yeah.
Or they could have done what they did when they filmed a stage version of it in 1998, where this is the stage version and we're just the camera is the audience and that's fine. But when they said, let's make them look like real cats, I think there was no way for the movie to
ever come back from that.
That was casting, sending it down the wrong road. I think also adding dialogue and trying to flesh out the plot of Cats, which again,
there is no plot of cats. It's basically a bunch of cats tweeting about how great they are.
It is literally
like loading TweetDeck and seeing several columns, one of which is like, look at me, I'm a criminal. Another one is, look at me, I'm fat. And another one is, look at me, I like to do magic.
The cats are going to sing and dance. And at the end, someone says, you, the old one, you get to live.
Yes.
And I guess the rest of the cats do not.
Yeah.
Just trying to turn cats into an actual
thing that makes
cinematic universe was probably a mistake. But you had a good point about why the CGI cats don't work, because they're completely the wrong scale.
They're the wrong scale. So this is, if there are technical terms, please jump in and tell us what they are. So the thing is, here's my crackpot theory, is when they designed the sets and the scale, what they did is they looked at like an actual cat or a series of actual cats and said, oh, you know what? Cats are about a foot tall from ear to paw. So we will just do everything on a 1-to-5 scale where one cat will shrink everybody down by a factor of 5. Mm-hmm. What they didn't consider is that cats aren't built on a vertical axis.
They're not vertical. They stretch out.
They're horizontal.
Yeah.
And so if you look at a cat horizontally, it's approximately 2.5 feet long from ear, from nose to extended tail. Mm-hmm. So what they should have done scale wise is gone with how a cat stretches out when it's on its hind legs, instead of going with, oh, well, you know, a cat is a foot high. These cats are now a foot high too. Because the scale is really disorienting. It's more mice-like. And so when you have...
Especially when the mice show up with human faces and...
Little child faces. Mm-hmm. And then the cockroaches beyond that. And you're just like, ah, this is... I have had fever dreams that make more sense than this. Mm-hmm. So the scale is deeply off. I will never, ever get over cats wearing shoes.
Yeah. Well, some cats wear shoes.
And some cats wear pants,
but other cats wear nothing.
There's a theory that the reason Taylor Swift is wearing shoes in her role as Bombalurina is to keep her feet off foot fetish sites, because it's apparently a thing.
But the other actors don't have that pull and will get their...
Look, Taylor Swift has a lot of constituencies.
I get it.
I remember this poor woman was also held up as a poster girl for white nationalism, too.
That's true.
Yeah, imagine her surprise when she found that out. There's going to be dudes out there. I don't know. It's just such a weird... all of the aesthetics are off. For all that we just had that meh, 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 Tim Burton, meh, 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 Alice in Wonderland thing that we did, it's an aesthetic universe that makes sense in a way. There's nothing underneath it, but there is a sort of visual logic. There's no visual logic here at all whatsoever. The scale is all off, which perpetually throws you off. The buildings are weirdly cat-sized, which also makes no sense unless, the movie is taking place in some sort of post-apocalyptic nightmare. You have two cats that are wearing, high-top leather sneakers and breakdancing, and cats in high-heeled shoes, which is also weird. There's an entire tap dancing sequence I will see in my nightmares.
I hope that tap dancing sequence is actually taught in film schools, because it is, how not to edit a musical sequence. Mm-hmm. So bored was I that at one point during that song, I was just counting the cuts that they make. And I stopped after
20
yeah. within a 90 second span. And it is absolutely how not to film a musical or how to take people right out of a musical. Yeah. It is just an incompetently assembled motion picture.
Yeah. The one huge thing, well, they do so many huge things wrong. What am I saying? The one huge thing, like there's just one. There are a lot of character choices I don't agree with. Like, for example, they let Rebel Wilson and James Corden off their leashes. And so you actually have
improving cats
meta commentary in the middle of songs.
Yeah.
Which, no. So there's those moments, but
Idris Elba seems like he's having a fine time.
Idris Elba, sex panther. That's basically what he is. Like, he slinks around and you're like, how is every cat on the set not pregnant? I mean, yeah. it's just, he looks
well, because he has no visible genitals is the problem.
But he's got like a visible 8-pack. That's so weird. Mm-hmm. Again, Idris Elba, sex panther.
Yeah.
No, my problem is with Jennifer Hudson's interpretation of Grisabella.
Well, that is...
Or the direction. I'm not sure if she chose to do it this way or she was told to do it this way. But here's the thing. I did see Dreamgirls. Mm-hmm. Great movie. Highly recommend it. Annika Noni Rose, Jennifer Hudson, and Eddie Murphy are all outstanding standouts in that movie. You watch it for them alone.
Apologies to the Beehive.
She doesn't need my attention. She's got plenty. No, I was just really stunned at how good how good Eddie Murphy is in that movie. Mm-hmm. But Jennifer Hudson makes a fantastic Effie because she's got that spine of steel underneath everything else. Like, her Effie knows when to gracefully recede and when to accept things by the end and when to push back and be really, I'm not going anywhere. So you expect that in this performer. And the thing about Grisabella is, she is a cat that's improbably managed to stay alive. The whole point to her character is that she persists. She's got a certain amount of grit and a certain amount of pride. And the reason she sings songs like Memory is this is a prideful character who's reckoning with the passage of time and the loss of opportunities and the consequences that have caught up to her. Right?
Right.
That's it. So that's how you play her. That's how Elaine Page plays her.
Betty Buckley.
Yes. And Jennifer Hudson sobs her way through the entire movie.
It is a weirdly weepy
she's like weeping
performance of Memory. Not weepy from the audience.
No, like but every weepy, single yeah. one of her scenes, she's like sobbing and trembling and cringing. And it's just, it's...
Well, it's unearned for one reason.
And number two, these are cats. Mm-hmm. I want to remind you. And if you think about animals, like the mammal least likely to sob.
The I ain't care of the animal kingdom.
Exactly. Like, I mean, how many internet pictures have you seen of cats who are giving you an injured look after you've just told them not to do something? Like, Jennifer Hudson doesn't play Grisabella as a cat. She plays her as
a mutated cat lady.
Well, they all are mutated. But she plays her like a dog. Mm. She plays her like a pack animal.
Wow.
Which is just baffling. And again, the reason she's exiled makes almost no sense because it seems to involve sex work, which is just like
it's a very prudish set of cats.
Given that they're writhing around each other naked, that's just yeah. like the fact that they're kink shaming a cat in a dress and a coat. Yeah,
there's one dance number where I wanted to turn to you. I couldn't because there was a 9-year-old sitting between us.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, Stanley Kubrick did this better in On His Wide Shut.
Yeah. Or Dario Argento.
Dario Argento is going, you stole my movie!
I'm Suspiria!
Oh, this was Suspiria, now it's with cats! You've ruined my last work!
And that's his third voice.
Yes, three voices. One more, but you'll have to pay extra for that.
And now it's time for us to shame you, like Grisabella. Like there's just so many moments in the movie where
I think, by the way, you've written the porn version of Cats now.
No. Idris Elba sex panther.
Yes, exactly.
But no, there's actually a moment where, first of all, you've got Ray
Winston.
Ray Winston is a cat.
Oh, interviewers who interview Ray Winston from now on, I think you will mention cats at your peril.
It's just so bizarre. It's like,
I'm Grand Tiger.
Yeah, it was basically.
Allie.
Yes.
Shot it.
But he's basically an enforcer cat.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where they're prodding Dame Judi Dench in her fur cat coat, which raises
They're going to make her walk the plank
and
on the
Thames. She turns around and she spits, "You'll never be my Jellicle choice." And I'm like, this is why she's a dame and I'm not, because like she managed to deliver that line. Mm-hmm. But no, the fur coats are also weird, because why do cats have fur coats? Are they made from their friends?
Those are all the cats who've gone back to different Jellicle lives. Like, first you're going to have to leave your fur. What? Womp. She's the Buffalo Bill of the
like, no, cats and fur coats are just so deeply weird. It's along with cats and shoes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help that at the end, when you do have the Jellicle ceremony, it reminded me of nothing so much as the Ascension ceremony in Logan's Run. So I'm like, are they sending that cat to be incinerated? Is that
probably
how... Oh my god.
It's a hot air balloon to the sun, so yes, quite possibly.
No, and none of it makes sense. It just, the whole movie was just one weird decision after another, and none of them paid off in any way where you're like, oh, that was a risk that they took, but it paid off. It was all I deeply don't get this. This is not attractive to look at. This is not even interesting to look at. It's just confusing. I don't understand why Idris Elba's cat has an 8-pack and the rest of them are weirdly bland. I don't get why some of them are in shoes. I don't understand how they're eating peas that are the size of their head, because cats are not that small. Just weird.
Yeah. So have there been any movies lately that we've seen that we like? Why don't we end on a positive note?
Yes, we saw a movie that's like 17 years old that we liked.
I've seen one more recently that I liked. Okay. Dolomite is My Name.
Oh, that's right. That was good.
On Netflix currently. It's
We're apparently big Eddie Murphy fans, this podcast.
Yes, Eddie Murphy, back to doing comedy. And it's a really good one. It's written by the same guys who did Ed Wood. And it's essentially the same style of picture, where it's people making a movie by hook or by crook.
I think what I found fascinating is you could argue that and Bowfinger would be a great double feature.
It really would.
Because Bowfinger is about the same thing, which is the shared delusion, or rather what happens when you have imagination but no talent.
Yes.
Or when you have ambition but no talent.
And it's Eddie Murphy in both pictures.
No, they're both. And it's a great movie. A lot of good performances. Keegan-Michael Key is really funny in it.
Mm-hmm. Wesley Snipes is very good. Apparently showed up on the set and decided he wasn't getting enough laughs. So he went in a different direction.
Went all in.
Yes.
So there was that. And then we also watched Layer Cake, which is the movie that actually convinced people to cast Daniel Craig as James Bond.
Right. And this is a pre-ripped Daniel Craig. This is where he looks like a...
He still looks like a human being here.
He looks like a fit human being, but he doesn't have like a 46-inch chest.
Actually, what I really liked about Layer Cake, which I hadn't seen when it came out, what I really liked is it's basically a who's who of British thespians. You've got Sally Hawkins as like a mall girlfriend, and she's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Ben Whishaw as a surprisingly pivotal and ineffectual young man.
You've got Tom Hardy before he gets ripped.
Yeah,
Maybe he and Daniel Craig went to the same gym.
Yeah, and I really like George Harris, who some people will also remember as Kingsley Shacklebolt in the Harry Potter movies. But George Harris plays an
Captain Katanga in the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
He plays a really great middle-aged enforcer who has a code, lives by it. And Cole Meany just, oh man, I loved his performance, especially the way he cocks his eyebrows.
No, it's on Netflix right now.
And,
not that this is a Netflix podcast, because honestly, we're thinking of canceling Netflix.
This is true.
But, you know, watch Layer Cake if you haven't before.
Exactly.
Or if you saw it the first time, watch it with new eyes.
Yeah, exactly. You can appreciate it. Again, the movie's almost 20 years old, and you can also appreciate this. I get the feeling this is where Matthew Vaughn kind of cut his teeth.
Yeah.
Before moving on to the stuff that we know him for now, like Kick-Ass and
Kingsman.
The Kingsman movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really like...
I don't like the Kingsman movies at all.
So, and again, it's a who's who, but in terms of doing comic book stuff where, oh, it's hyper-violent, just like the comics, haha. You know what I actually prefer is The Boys, which is on Amazon Prime, and it's a TV series. So that's a recommendation as well. Again, we ruin movies for the most part, but I'm going to also recommend The Boys if you have Amazon Prime. And you're like, I would like a little hyper-violent, funny and disturbing stuff. So, So that was it. Definitely no weeping cats. In any event, this has been our holiday week edition of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. I have been Lisa Schmeiser.
And I, for now, have been Philip Michaels.
Man of four voices.
Man of four voices.
Three of them you've heard.
And we'll see you either in 2020 or depending on when this podcast gets uploaded. Welcome to 2020, friends. Yes. I come from the future.
Tell us what the future is like.
Yes.
Anyway, have a great 2020. We'll see more of you then.
Mm-hmm.